that saying go? All's fair in love, war, and fish fry? I don't know. Something close to that. Hi there. Welcome to another episode of this here electronic engineering podcast called Amelia's Weekly Fish Fry, brought to you by eejournal.com and hosted by yours truly, Amelia Dalton. So evolution is the name of the game in this week's Fish Fry. We're talking about the evolution of tactical systems, the evolution of interconnects. But first, let's start things off with a little news you may have missed. The evolution of flight. Now, if you didn't know already, yes, I was named after one of the coolest aviators of all time, Amelia Earhart. And my whole life, I've been a bit obsessed with flight. But unfortunately, the lack of any kind of functioning inner ear has kept me from the cockpit. But have you ever considered, like I have, how did birds come to fly? I mean, it wasn't just one day, right? Hey, Bob, look what I can do. Yeah, that's a perfect prehistoric bird name, if you were wondering. Bob. Okay, so before we go any further, let's get out our aviary history textbooks and review the timeline of bird evolution. Now, we all know that there is a general consensus that birds have evolved from specific types of dinosaurs. And one such bird was called the Archaeopteryx. Now, it lived about 150 million years ago and was the size of a raven, but had an odd mix of avian and reptilian features. Like, it had feathers and wings, but also teeth and a tail. So yeah, sounds kind of scary and kind of like you want to pet it at the same time. So yeah, this guy probably glided or hopped like you'd see a modern day pheasant do. Now, there are other equally hard to pronounce dinosaur birds that did about the same thing. But what about other dinosaur evolved birds? Did they all glide until they could fly? Probably not. Let me introduce you to Claudipteryx. Now, this guy was more like the size of a peacock and is the earliest known non-flying dinosaur to boost a pair of feathered proto-wings. So even though it couldn't fly, this Claudipteryx might be the key to unlocking the mysteries of the evolution of avian flight. So the working theory is that the Claudipteryx's wings might have flapped when it ran, and then that could have led to the eventual evolution of active flight. So, to test out this theory, a team of researchers analyzed the mechanical effects of running different parts of the Claudipteryx's body. Now, how did they do this? A robot, of course! So this team actually built a life-size Claudipteryx robot that could run at three different speeds on a treadmill. Yes, a treadmill. And guess what? Just like they thought, the motion of running caused those wings to flap. And they tested this theory even further by fitting artificial wings to the back of a young ostrich. Bad day for that ostrich, right? So lead author of this story puts it like this. Our work shows that the motion of flapping feathered wings was developed passively and naturally as the dinosaur ran on the ground. Although this flapping motion could not have lifted the dinosaur into the air at that time, the motion of flapping wings may have developed earlier than gliding. Huh, super cool, right? So the mystery of avian flight evolution has been solved. Check. Okay, maybe not completely. There are more tests to be run and more robots to get running on treadmills. If you want any further information about this study, I've included a couple links below the player on this week's Fish Frying page on eejournal.com, including a video of that ostrich in question. Poor dude. And even a link to a white paper called Identification of Avian Flapping Motion from Non-Volant Winged Dinosaurs Based on Model Effective Mass Analysis. All right, from avian evolution to aviation evolution, please welcome Rod Persons from Artisan to talk about the evolution of tactical systems and the role encryption will play in the future of battlefield communications. Thank you so much for joining me, Rob.
Great to be here.
Okay, so we're talking about the evolution of tactical systems today. Now, we've gone from the old days of huge closed systems to COTS, network-centric systems. Now, Rob, how exactly is data shared in these newer systems?
In many cases, systems are really a connection of a variety of server blades that are interconnected through integrated switches. And in the case of advanced TCA, they actually have a pair of switches that can be used for a variety of reasons. Either use them as redundant switches, or you could use them for different types of tactical data. Today, the switches can operate at 10 and 40 gigabits per second, and future designs should be able to give you some even higher speeds if necessary. Definitely looking at some newer designs that would have higher uplink support.
Now, Rob, what's the encryption story here? Is all of this data encrypted?
It depends. It's really up to the user of the application. Do they want to actually encrypt just at centralized points, maybe at the switches, either the top of rack switch or the integrated switch inside the chassis itself? We think in general that the trend will be towards trying to encrypt data locally on each of the server blades, even potentially using the encryption algorithms that they run on those to even encrypt things like storage information. But in general, for sure, it's where they're sharing the data. Any place where there could be an access point, somebody could come in and actually look at the data going across some sort of network bus and decide that they want to try to take the data away. So if you encrypt it, they can't gain access to it.
That makes sense. Now, what kinds of methods are you seeing today? And are these approaches different for tactical data in particular?
Yeah, today, there are quite a few military systems out there that actually support encryption. So if you're doing battlefield communications, if you're doing battlefield data centric sorts of things, there are a variety of applications out there today that are actually take advantage of well-known codecs that are designed for those purposes. Or it could be, you know, airborne types of applications where you have ships trying to talk to an aircraft to be able to share some tactical data. And it's different from what we see today in tactical systems where most of that data is not encrypted. So within the system, they don't worry about encryption, but there is a trend towards being more concerned about cybersecurity access and being able to take advantage of potential access points into that system to be able to take it while it's being actually operated on.
Okay, so speaking of encryption, let's talk about hardware acceleration of encryption and the Intel Quick Assist technology. So for my audience who may not know, what is that all about and how could it help my tactical system?
Quick Assist is actually a functional unit that has traditionally been part of processor controller hub interfaces, but not directly in the controller hub, the PCH that's right with the processors doing some I/O functionality. They tend to be additional SKUs that you'd have to add to your boards or your products that would then have a PCI Express lane from the processor to be able to actually convert that data into an encrypted form or decrypt it, either way. Quick Assist also has the capabilities of doing compression and decompression. So if you want to actually take advantage of increase the amount of bandwidth that you can get out of an existing network interface, then you could use that functionality. Primarily what we're looking at is the ability to take hardware offload where algorithms in the past could take up multiple cores to actually process that data, bring those cores back and be able to use those for real work, and use Quick Assist for actually doing the actual encryption part of it. And it's a hardware-based encryption algorithm.
All right, Rob, it's time for your off-the-cuff question. Now, normally I write these, but I'm going to let you write this one probably for the first time of you being on my show. So let's go.
So what did you do this weekend, Rob? I had a surprise birthday party for my wife and pulled it off. And it was almost a disaster trying to keep away from the venue long enough so that I could actually get it done. Had to get my daughter involved to help me actually figure out how to do it. We went to Spider-Man. We got there late, had to sit in the front seat only. She didn't want to go in the movie, so I said, I don't know what else I can do. So my daughter was able to convince her to go in, and the party was saved based on that.
That is awesome. I love that story. And good job on the husband front there, Rob. Well, I think that's all I have time for today. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks a bunch. I appreciate being here.
Keeping with our theme this week, let's bring in Kat Brandis and Rich Selfridge from Amphenol to talk about the evolution of intelligent interconnects. Let's go. My guest today is Kat Brandis from Amphenol. Thank you so much for joining me, Kat.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Okay, so first off, since you guys haven't been on my show before, what is Amphenol all about?
Well, Amphenol provides interconnect solutions for the military, industrial, as well as communications markets.
Okay, great. So you guys just released a next generation VPX. So Kat, what kind of applications is this VPX good for, and what kind of specs are we looking at here?
So in terms of applications, we're talking about electronic warfare applications, we're talking about radar applications, any application that utilizes high data transfer. As far as specs that are associated with this type of product, we're talking about Vita 46, specifically Vita 46.3, the next-gen high-speed version. We are very active in the 46.3 group and already have our design and part numbers within that spec. It's intermountable with the legacy 46 connectors. That being said, from a performance standpoint, our connector is rated to 32 gigabits plus margin. So definitely the fastest connector out there right now for that type of speed, and especially something that will be qualified to 46.3.
Next up, we got Rich Selfridge from Amphenol. So Rich, your talk at ETT this year was called Intelligent Interconnects with Integrated Electronics. So first off, what exactly do you mean by intelligent interconnects?
Hey, Amelia. It's great to be here today. So what I mean by intelligent interconnects is that I want the interconnect structure to actually observe itself, to monitor itself, and have the intelligence to take that information and manipulate its structure itself. That's the ultimate dream that I have.
Okay, great. So Rich, what are the biggest challenges we should be addressing with these intelligent interconnects?
So the biggest challenge that I see is the integration of the processing capability. So we've done a lot of intelligent interconnects already for the data side, where we're like doing media converters, converting from fiber optics to electronic signals or an electronic signals to fiber optic signals. And we've done protocol changes for data transmission and network switching. So they're all very data-centric, and they have a specific function, but they're not really trying to analyze the behavior of the interconnect structure and make adjustments on the fly. That's where I see the evolution of these interconnect systems. If they can become intelligent and autonomous, such that they are monitoring themselves, so that the box designers on a platform can worry about their primary function. As Kat said, there's radar processing systems, things like that. That's their sweet spot. Sure. We can take care of the data manipulation and power manipulation for the platform itself, taking that weight off of these box designers. That's the intent.
All right, Rich, it's time for your off-the-cuff question. Now, this is a bit of a standard on Fish Fry, but since you haven't been on my show before, here we go. If you had one last meal on planet Earth, that's it. That's all you're going to eat for the rest of your life. What would it be?
Wow, far out, Amelia. One last meal. Oh, my goodness. I guess it would be a nice salmon dish, because I love salmon.
Okay.
Maybe a salad, some salmon, and some wonderful dessert. I don't know.
That's a good enough answer for me. Well, I think that's all I have time for today. Thank you, Kat and Rich, for joining me.
Thank you so much, Amelia.
Thank you.
Hey, have you checked out EE Journal on social media yet? Well, you should. You can find us at facebook.com/EEJournal. If you're into Twitter, you can monitor our tweets at EEJournalTFM. And don't forget, if you want to follow my personal Twitter account, it is AmeliaD1978. And hey, if LinkedIn is your thing, well, sure, you can follow us on LinkedIn as well. And we have a YouTube channel, keyword EE Journal. Folks, it is chock full of all kinds of techie videos, including our very popular Chalk Talk webcast series hosted by yours truly. And you can subscribe to our EE Journal YouTube channel as well. Also, by clicking the links below the player on this week's Fish Fryin' page, you can check out the Fish Fry Archive or subscribe to Fish Fry via the iTunes Store. And remember, if you want any further information about the stories covered in today's show, just head on over to eejournal.com and look for this week's Fish Fryin' page. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. If you know of any cool new technology, any fun EE conference coming up that I absolutely should attend, or even the best geeky hotspot in your city, I love that stuff, shoot me a line at amelia@eejournal.com. I promise I will respond, or post a comment on our forums on EE Journal. For the week of August 16th, 2019, I'm Amelia Dalton. And you've been fried.